This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This recording was made at Reach 2022, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders Educational Programs on March 24 and 25, 2022, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
So, you know, I've been so inspired by some of the talks that we've had here. Really enjoyed being here. Being an Old Order Mennonite, I'm a little bit out of my comfort zone. I admit that. But it's good to be here. And then I hear all these good, inspiring talks. Talks where we reach out and worship the Lord. And then I get to talk about a subject we rather would not talk about. Verily I say unto you, except you be converted and become as little children, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoso shall receive one such little child in my name receiveth me. But whoso shall offend one of these little ones who believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and that he were drowned in the depths of the sea. Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come, but woe to that man by whom offense cometh. Wherefore, if thy hand or thy foot offend thee, cut them off and cast them into the sea. It is better for thee to enter into life, halt or maimed, than having two hands or two feet to be cast into everlasting fire. It is not the will of your Father which is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. Picked out a few verses here from Matthew 7. Very familiar verses. Verses that most of you could have quoted with me. And when we think of the terms Jesus used here about the kingdom of heaven and entering into life, what do we think of? Do we think of some future home in heaven when our journey here is past? When I think of that, you know, I really think he was also talking about the kingdom of heaven here on earth, that we enter life here. If we don't have that life within us today, we will not have it after we leave this earth. Isn't that entering into this life what it means when we need to cut off that which offends, cut off that which has been past us? Was it not already in this life that Jesus said, you know, that he valued children highly enough that he recommended throwing abusers into the sea with a millstone around their neck? Did I say that right? That Jesus actually makes such radical statements? As I come to this subject of abuse within our settings and how we handle those, I do want to take the time to remind us that it is only one of the issues facing our churches today. Yes, a very urgent issue that in the past we did tend to ignore. But let's not now make the mistake of swinging to the other extreme, to the extent that we focus on it so much that we ignore many other pressing issues. I just want to say that right at the beginning here. The world does not have a very good record of staying on the middle path. How about us? This issue of abuse is similar to many others that we have, you know, as many other social issues that we've faced over the years. and that society has faced. It's like a huge pendulum that swings from the one side to the other. And we all know in the world when that pendulum comes down into the middle, it doesn't stop swinging. It keeps going the other direction. Perhaps we did not purposely sweep these issues under the rug in the past. It's possible that it was our ignorance. But you know, does that excuse us? When Peter and John extended the grace of God to the cripple at the temple's gray gate, and the power of God, through the disciples' word, raised him up so that suddenly the people saw him running and jumping. And then Peter preached to them, and he told them that you crucified the Son of God, and he said, and now, brethren, I wot that through ignorance you did it, as did also your rulers. Did that excuse them? Neither does it excuse us. We do need to face that issue and face it squarely. To now suddenly focus on this one issue to the extent that, A, it takes so much of our energy that we tend to ignore other equally pressing issues, or that it ends up creating a culture of fear and suspicion in our settings, would that not be playing right into the devil's hands? Just putting that out in the beginning, because in the 15 years I've been working with abused situations, I have seen that pendulum swinging. Paul wrote to the Philippians, let your moderation be known unto all men. The Lord is at hand. But I'm going to move on into abuse is real, and it is happening today yet. Let's look at some of these. How can we, as a Christian people, create a safe culture within our churches and organizations to avoid every appearance of evil? And I've broken this into four subcategories. As with most challenges that face the church, it's impossible to neatly compartmentalize everything into little categories and subjects, and each situation organization is different that's represented here. So you'll notice that some of these will overlap. But let's go to screening first of all. Proper procedures for screening is important as we bring in new staff and volunteers. But I want to say right in the beginning that screening is by its very nature limited as to what it can accomplish. A perpetrator does not get up in the morning and decide, I'm going to be a perpetrator today. Most perpetrators do not want to be perpetrators. Their addiction, which, by the way, usually almost always started in the very young teens, is something which in most cases they want to be free from. They have tried and found freedom and fallen and risen and tried again. Because most of them have found freedom multiple times and then fallen again and again, their thinking, their worldview has become distorted. When they lie about their past and their failures, it doesn't feel like a lie to them. There's a good chance at the time when they're coming to your organization or church that they are again in that cycle where they have found freedom. They may be convinced that this time is for real. This time they won't fall again. So it feels to them, with the walls, emotional walls built around their hurting hearts, that this has been permanently put behind them and really wasn't that much a part of them anyway. It's hard for us to grasp it, but that's actually how they feel. And so when they tell you that they are free, that though this is not something they're involved in, when they glibly answer your questions, it they believe their own lies. It doesn't feel to them like lying. And therefore, they are very convincing. We've seen that over and over. So that makes it very hard to catch the people in screening. Just so you know why, I'm just trying to give you a picture of why it's hard to catch perpetrators in your screening. It's still very important to have the proper screening tools, but realizing that those, what are the limits of that? But we still need a good screening process. Background checks. When we think of background checks, we may think of going to the state police and being fingerprinted, and you know all those background checks, statewide perpetrator database. You know, and there are cases where that is necessary, and some organizations that is recommended. But you know, most of us in our tight knit Anabaptist communities, we have a much better background check available than that. We recommend that for those working in outreaches and missions, contact be made with the home church. Now, I know most of the organizations take that for granted, but I'm saying actually ask questions, actually get a true recommendation from the home church. That's the best background check you can have. And I'm not talking about some bishop living in another community that happens to know them. I'm talking about the home ministry that works with them on a regular basis. That should be the first and most effective background check. And every organization is different. You have to know what is recommended for your organization. When I became a member of the Christian Aid Ministry Support Group years ago, they required that background check with my home ministry. That was just standard, and I really appreciate that. Then the next one, incorporating good questions about past relationships. That one is much harder because remember, and the denial that these people live in. But in a nonprofit organization, which I work as in, when I interview a new staff member, I really want to ask them. It's really important to me to know about past relationships with the home church, with former employers. You know, you can find out a lot about why did you leave where you were before? What is your relationship? Tell me about a time when you disagreed with someone above you. And how did it turn out? And then when they tell me a story, what's your relationship with that person today? You know, that tells you so much. I still so well remember a girl coming from a very conservative church. And I asked about her, why she left the place before, and about her relationship there. She just said, well, that management, they just didn't know how to handle people. I mean, and she started really talking badly about them. We were desperate for a nurse. We hired her. Well, you know what? Her next management was not any different. Amos Stolzfus and I met with many of the residential counseling centers around here to help them establish the background checks and the questions that they should be asking when they hire new staff. That's something that some of the nonprofit organization around here have been doing. And then they actually have a form that they have the home ministry sign. That's just something like Kurtz Homestead, which is a residential program for girls, especially abused girls. So the staff, it's just so important that we know where they come from. There are situations where we need to consider legal background checks. There are varying opinions in some of our constituencies that I work with, especially the more conservative ones, on that. As we keep approaching the end time, there is increasing pressure from the government to regulate religious activities, and sometimes it feels as if they were doing that. But I do recommend if you're running an organization that works with individuals that are from multiple backgrounds or working with multiple backgrounds, I really do recommend the official background check that is mandated in Pennsylvania. May we be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. So those are the four things that I've had on there, the fourth one being coming back to that, being aware of the limitations of the screening process. And the reason that we move on, that I say that again, is because then we move on to the next one, which is boundaries. Again, it is important, you know, due diligence is in order, but it is important that we do not foster a culture of fear and suspicion. So let's talk about proper guidelines, some of the things that we should consider. What is the most important component of establishing safe boundaries within an organization? Anybody want to guess what the one most important key is? It's accountability. Within the organization, the one most important component is accountability. Yes, we need specific policies, guidelines, boundaries to help keep us and our organization safe, but they should all be built around the center pole of accountability. And would it be possible to focus so much on possible abuse that we actually might stifle the good that individuals do? And the reason I'm coming back to this again is because the whole issue of accountability is fraught with that tension between allowing individual workers the freedom to reach out to those with needs so that he or free or she is free to make decisions that need to be made at the moment, and yet have the proper accountability to avoid all appearance of evil. I'll just give you a little possible scenario to show you what I mean. Let's say that to avoid the possibility of abuse, your organization may have a policy that an individual staff member is not to go to a child's home alone. And depends what the organization is doing, that's a very good policy. So let's say a nurse on your staff is out on the street and a child tells her that her mother is at home very ill. It sounds life-threatening. The nurse is faced with a decision. Does she obey the organization's policies and refuse to go to the child's home? Or does she violate the guidelines that have been put in place for everybody's safety? Isn't there a way that we can find to have accountability without such strict guidelines that they don't stifle autonomous reaching out? It should be possible for the nurse in this situation to do what needs to be done with the full confidence that she is serving the Lord and that management will stand behind her in that. So what I recommend, what if your policy had a, what if your rules had a policy that under circumstances, we understand that there may be circumstances that this doesn't fit. All that we need to in those cases is to have a full accounting of what happened. Does that make sense? You know, then you're not overriding accountability. You still get a report. It's just simple. You know, one of the things that we have in our, we get these in the medical center, we get these super bills, and the doctor is supposed to charge full price for everybody that comes through. And the doctor decides this is a hardship case and can cross that out and put zero in and not charge that person anything. It's against the rules, but as long as that is circled in red and put on my desk for me to see what has been done, that is okay. I'm just giving you an example that, you know, as long as you have the structure that you need there. So each of the organizations has different ways of how that could be handled. So you avoid all appearance of evil. That's the first one, without suppressing the reaching out in love. I'm not used to using PowerPoint, so sometimes I'll have to catch up here. So look at your own structure of your own organization and put that accountability and override structure in place. So now, how about boundaries tailored to specific situations? Now, in licensed professionals have strict legal guidelines, and ordinarily we don't need to add much to those. In the mental health facility where I work, the therapist and psychiatrist may take a child or a young woman into a room alone. That is acceptable in professional settings, you know, and their guidelines are so strict. And if they get blamed for crossing boundaries, the retaliation in the legal world is so swift that we feel that is enough in those situations. But most of us, that's not the kind of organization we work in. So Whispering Hope Counseling Center retreat, I've been out there many times, and they have a rule that if one of their, they counsel men and women, and if one of their male counselors has a session with a female, there must be someone else, a third person along. There are no exceptions in that kind of setting. Just to avoid every appearance of evil. For myself, when I interview new staff members at the Parochial Medical Center, those need to be conducted in a window, in a room with a window. So I can interview a new staff member, a young nurse, but it's in a room with a window. So whatever works for your organizations. Having specific guidelines in working with children or single women. Again, your organization has to tailor that to what you are actually facing in your organization. Those are important, but the next one is the most important, the red flags to watch for. In almost every case that we know of perpetrators being discovered on the mission field or in an organization, there were many red flags that could have been noticed if only we would have known about them, if only we would have been aware of them. And they are really hard. You know, where do you draw that line? What's the most important red flag? Well, the first the most important one is unfortunately also the red flag that is the hardest to detect. Is the individual's background dysfunctional? Does he or she have unfulfilled needs in his emotional and spiritual life? Now, the truth is, That is a prime motivator for many young people going to the mission field. How many young people desire to reach out to others because of emotional needs in their own lives? You know, I talked to one administrator on the mission field, and he said that's one of the reasons that many young people come, not nearly all of them. And that's not necessarily bad. Some of those do find fulfillment on the mission field. But it's still, you know, and this is different from the intake. When you're doing the intake questions, there it will be very hard to find out about it. It's once they're on the mission field and you have day-to-day working with them that those things come out, that they start talking about their parents or their uncle or their home church and how badly they were used, especially someone that has moved multiple times from one church to the other. How do they talk about former churches where they have been a member? You know, and sometimes it's very persuasive. Sometimes the churches that they came out of sound very dark, but you're only hearing one side of the story. That is a very good indicator that there's something wrong. That's the number one red flag. Now, a red flag is not proving that that person is a perpetrator. It's simply cluing you in that something is not the way it should be and that you want to watch for other things. So if it's a young person that had unfulfilled needs and they decide to go on the mission field and they find fulfillment in that, then they will overcome the emotional baggage that they came with or that they've had in their past. How do they view their parents, church, you know, the church, former churches, or the friends that they grew up with? We don't want to suddenly become suspicious of everybody that didn't have a perfect upbringing. We'd be suspicious of everybody. So just realize where we put that. Okay, number two, are any of your staff prone to unusual alliances or friendships with children or young people? Some abusers, because of their feelings of insecurity, have a hard time connecting and getting close to other adults. They're social connections with other adults may only be surface connections, and it's hard to get really close to them since they may have a hard time making heart connections with those in their age category. They may be more comfortable reaching out to children, and maybe they do have a special way with children of connecting with them, having the ability to make a child feel special, complimenting the child on their good looks or anything they can make the child feel special and important. They may have a tendency of reaching out to vulnerable children who feel rejected or inferior or who come from broken or dysfunctional families. And remember that most of these children that are abused, I've seen that in many organizations where there was an abuser. Most of the children that were abused, almost all of them in almost every case, were children that had dire emotional needs. That's who they pick on. So the children that they befriend may be very needy for love, for affirmation. They're crying out for love, and they seem unlovable and awkward to other people. And then they become easy targets. And they do need someone to make them feel special and needed and appreciated. And the perpetrator takes advantage of this. Rarely will a perpetrator use physical violence. He will usually make the child feel special until he gains that child's trust and he can do with them because they trust him what he wants. Even the actual abuse at the time usually does not feel like abuse. Have you noticed something here? A good missionary for a heart with a heart for children will have many of the same characteristics. How sorely we do need workers who have that special talent to reach out to children and young people who are needy, who come from dysfunctional homes, who are crying out for love. How much we do need young people that can connect with them and help guide them in the right direction. Do you see the parallel? So let's not suddenly be suspicious of all people that have that talent. It's one of those red flags to put into place with the rest of them. A very important one. The time to be concerned is if they really tend to single out certain children and spend more and more time with them, especially if they start giving them favors and taking them along on trips and so forth. If you see a child developing a dependency, emotional dependency on a worker, that's, you know, a true talent, a true missionary will reach, use that talent to draw the child closer to God and others, not only to themselves. That's one of the, I know it's hard to differentiate that sometimes, but it's one of the things that really are a good marker. Do you have individuals within your organization who do not appreciate accountability? And that is often the case. They end up not appreciating accountability. Accountability is key. So it should be a reason for a concern if an individual finds all kinds of excuses to avoid accountability. Do you see a pattern emerging? You know, does it sound familiar? I know I should have called, but, you know, something happened, whatever. Or I don't know why you had to know about every little thing that I do, you know. Or maybe he just even doesn't verbalize it, but he doesn't show up for the morning devotions or meetings sometimes. Or, you know, that's another key in there. Some people are just always there, and the others miss things, and so again, it's just one of the keys in watching for the red flags. And a warning. Do not make the mistake of thinking that an individual could not be an abuser since he is doing so much good. That has been the mistake that has been made in many situations and organizations. And I'm not picking on anyone. It is not unusual. They often have skills and talents that seem to be indispensable within the organization. And the good they do is not necessarily a cover-up for the abuse. They may actually have a heart for those whom they're helping. They honestly may want to help people and may be very good at the job they're doing. And they're planning to change, remember? They're planning to not fall again. This time, this is it. This time, it's not unusual for staff members to see the warning signs, but to say, it can't be true. You know, I know that person too well. All the good he's doing, it can't be true. I know of cases where a child was punished for lying, punished severely for lying when they told the truth, because they knew that person would not do anything like that. Do not make the mistake of thinking that an individual could not be an abuser since he is doing so much good. And then, just mentioning this, the power differential that exists in any aid organization. This is nothing new. It's just the words I'm choosing. You know, an organization does not create a power differential. It is there. I know Arnold Eby talks about theoretically handing out tarps, the theoretical story of handing out tarps in the mountains of Nepal after a storm has gone through and everybody needs roofs. These people are truly needy and you're handing out those tarps. there are not enough tarps to go around. You're handing it out to the most needy. You have the power to decide who gets that. There is a very real power differential there. You can spend all day telling them how they're your equal. You are not above them. But there is a power differential. You have the power at the wave of your hand to say he gets a tarp and he doesn't. That's how aid organizations operate. That's part of being an aid organization. I can't give you the answer to what to do about that. I'm just saying this. A perpetrator often takes advantage of this power differential. You know that's wrong. A perpetrator always takes an advantage of a power differential. In every setting that I have ever met a perpetrator, they take advantage of the power differential. It's just, I'm just saying that to put you in, so that's something to be aware of, you know. One of the ways is making sure there's good ways of having feedback from those receiving aid, you know, but that's another subject. The next one, whistleblower policies. Now, take whistleblower comments seriously. This may seem so obvious, but the truth is, in most cases of abuse on the mission fields, an individual came to someone in management with concerns long before the abuse was discovered and acknowledged, and was summarily dismissed. You know why? Because quite often, it is the troublemaker in your organization that will bring it to you. How well I remember one of the chief troublemakers in my team, the same girl I just talked about that had trouble with their prior bosses, came to me with suspicions of one of our managers being on drugs. This individual came from a broken family. She had lots of problems. She turned many an employee against me. Her way of working was not to my face, it was around my back. I have some gray hairs on my head because of her. Can you imagine how serious I took it when she told me that she thinks this individual's on drugs? But she was right. That is quite often the case. Much of the whistleblowing will not come. The first whistleblowing will, most cases, not come from trusted sources. Now, this doesn't mean that your troublemaker comes to you with yet another complaint that you have to launch a full-scale investigation. It does mean that you don't just dismiss them. You actually thank them for it and make note of it. And perhaps do a little digging. In the CCI, where we work with abuse situations, we have many members across the different communities. And we have a rule that every situation that comes, that gets reported, regardless if even if it's not serious, gets reported to the chairman. So that there is a central clearinghouse. And that is one of the ways that there was a case where somebody came to one of us with suspicions on a certain grandfather within the community. And you know, that couldn't be true. This grandfather was a post in the community. Positively not. We thanked him for coming. You know, told him that we appreciate that he's brings it to our attention. When he left, you know, we kind of dismissed it. Then, from another direction, we had another one. And, well, took a little more notice this time. After the fourth report came to a fourth person, then we did a full-scale investigation. Now, do you know what would have happened if we would not have had a central clearinghouse? That's so important. Anything that happens within the organization that is in any way suspicious needs to all come to one person. That is very important in the whistleblowing subject. And of course, anonymous reporting, that is so important. Never dismiss them. Always thank them for coming. Make sure they know that it's a safe to come to you. You will not use their name unless you get their permission. Unless it's reportable, sometimes you will need to, but in most cases that legally you do not need to bring a whistleblower. In fact, I don't know that you ever need to bring a whistleblower name to the authority unless he was part of the situation. The few notes I would like to make at the end. How much training on abuse recognition should be required for staff within the organization? And I'd like to put this into perspective. Most of the aid organizations will never or almost never need to deal with this. Okay? So why have a huge organization or even an organization within a small organization, let's say it's a small organization, and the chance that you'll ever have someone that will perpetrate within that organization isn't that large, do you need to have another organization within the organization to deal with abuse? I say no. Use something like the abuse care group, as a resource. When we do land transactions, we use a lawyer. We don't expect our people to have the training to do that. We have resources to go to. And we do recommend that your organization should be focusing on the good that you're doing, and you should have resources for these kinds of situations once the policies are in place. Sometimes you need, if it's a larger organization, you may want to have your organization leaders and whatever you call them, the heads of the departments, have some training like I gave you today. That might be a very good idea. But let's not foster a culture of suspicion by training all our staff on all these things. I think that would be counterproductive. Coming back again to this where the pendulum is swinging the other direction. Not meaning we sweep it under the rug. Just not. Let's stay away from now going to the other extreme. Okay. Well, like I said, this is not a topic that most of us would rather talk about. It is really hard for me to stand in front of people and talk about this topic. I appreciate your attentiveness and hope God can bless you as you go from here.
Thank you for listening. All recordings from Reach 2022 are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. To purchase additional recordings from Reach or other Faith Builders events, visit us online at www.christianlearning.org or call us at 814-789-4769.